We have Sandy tonight.
I'm Sandy, I'm an alcoholic.
Sandy.
Sponsor always told me to
get dressed.
Well, I was dressed. Alright, so I'm an alcoholic. So I need to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. A couple things, like I have probably, I can count on two hands how many times I've been drunk. It's more into dry goods. For those that believe that they can, you know, that are in that situation and believe that they can still drink, more power to you. I was not one of those people. So I was born in Connecticut. I would say probably the first years of my life that I don't remember were pretty good. I do remember being in school, just wanting to be loved by everybody. And it's not like I wasn't loved by my family, because I was. I just felt like I needed to have people like me. I needed to have attention. At my aunt's wedding, I think I was like 5 when my aunt got married, to give you an idea. So there was this tree out in front of the church, and I was wearing a tux, and I was like yay big, and I had tails, and I was like, I'm gonna climb this tree. So I was like out there before the wedding climbing a tree in my tuxedo, and people were just kind of chasing me around, and that is kind of the story of my life, just kind of like just doing wild shit. Probably around, you know, the age of 8, to get people's approval, I just lied about shit all the time. All the time. For no reason at all. Like, I would say, yeah, I have a Nintendo at home. No, I didn't. My father was not going to let that happen. Another thing about my family is, like, everybody was, like, super hyper successful, family of overachievers, and there was always pressure to be successful, especially in academics. I did not want to be successful in academics. I wanted to be cool. And all the, you know, this was back in the day when being a nerd, being into school was not cool, right? Or at least in my eyes, it was not cool. And kind of, you know, I just kind of fucked off. I remember coming home, getting home before my dad. My dad would come home and he'd be like, did you do your homework? I'd be like, yeah. No, for a while I did not. Because what I wanted to do was plop down in front of the TV and watch movies or watch something. Shortly after I turned 8, my parents were like, you know, they were having some issues, and they were like, you know, we're gonna get divorced. I had a sister, by the way. We'll get to that. My sister was home from, my sister went to boarding school in Connecticut. So where I was raised, I have kind of jumped around here. Where I was raised was in New Jersey, and so after I was born, we moved to Maryland for a bit, and then we moved to New Jersey, and that's where I grew up, and that's where I started drinking. Parents were going to get a divorce, and shit was just kind of falling apart with my parents. Like, they were sleeping in separate bedrooms. Shortly thereafter, my father was going to lose his job because of his position. The way it worked was, is like, so he worked in government, and so the governor appointed, you know, this guy, and then this guy appointed this guy, right? So it was governor, chancellor, vice chancellor, and that was my dad. My dad was vice chancellor. And so the chancellor dude was retiring. His replacement was going to, not be him, right? Because the dude had the pick. So shit was just kind of messed up, right? And home life was, other than the divorce, pretty normal, whatever that means. I never wanted, I pretty much got whatever I wanted. So my parents also, like, really wanted to, like, culture me. So, like, they made me, like, try out for plays and organ lessons and, you know, they maybe auditioned for the choir, this, that, and the other, right? One night, so me and my mother went to my organ lesson, and we got done, we came home, and we opened the garage door and for her side, and there was a car in there. Typically that's not the case. So we get out, we go towards the car, and my mom gets there first, and she says, she looks into the car is running, she looks in and is like, yo, your dad's trying to kill himself, you need to go call 911. So I run to the neighbors, call 911, lo and behold, my dad does not survive. And so it's pretty tore up, And it's one of those like situations where like I think being a child, being 9 years old, was probably a good thing because, you know, there's only so much that you can comprehend, right? So it was pretty traumatic, obviously. I say obviously like it's not obvious. It was pretty traumatic. So I remember staying out of school, and I also remember, like, taking advantage of the situation, right? So I was like, all right, well, you know, I don't really have to go to school. I can just kind of fuck off. So that was when I was nine. Passed me into fourth grade, between, you know, in where I grew up in New Jersey. I know sometimes middle school in other places is sixth grade. Where I grew up was fifth grade. So I'm also, like, I was bullied like you wouldn't believe in school. So start middle school, still completely fucking off. Did not want to do school. I can actually remember, like, so we had these like math tests where they were timed, and when you finished, you know, you wrote your time on the paper, right? So I wanted the fastest time, so I would just write numbers on the paper. And that eventually actually got me in trouble. But so lo and behold, that would have been 1990. And so Christmas time, 1990, my sister comes home and she wasn't feeling well. She comes home for Christmas and she wasn't feeling well. She couldn't like eat anything. And so we took her to the doctor. Doctor was like, there's something in your throat. So they were like, you know, you need to go to the hospital. Went to the hospital. Turns out she had a tumor, cancer in her throat. And that was like December. She got admitted to the hospital. January, she died. About like 16 days before the first anniversary of my father's death. So again, you know, like I'm gonna take advantage of this shit, right? So yeah, I was sad. Yeah, I was fucked up, but you know, I was gonna take advantage of this. And I say this, right? So like, and I say this like it's super fucked up, but I mean, you know, as a child, like, you just don't know. So, and my mom is like, I love my mom, and she's great, but she has just, like, emotionally just, like, checked out, right? So me and her are just not, like, emotionally connected at all at this point. She had a very good job, so I never wanted for anything, but emotionally she was just checked out, and I mean, I, you know, looking back on it, I really can't fault her. She had just lost her husband, and her daughter, and then, you know, the following year she lost her mother, so that would have been 92, she lost her mother, my grandmother, and by this point, you know, death was just, you know, I was just kind of numb to this. It was like, okay, you know, it's another one. So that was probably around sixth grade, and I started getting into a lot of trouble around that time. So I got my first suspended from school my first time. I threw a pen at somebody and it almost gashed their eye out. I got pretty lucky. But yeah, I was an idiot. And so, around the time I was 13, I had my first drink. No, not my first drink, my first drunk. Because my parents I loved them to give me sips of their alcohol. I loved them to give me sips of their alcohol. And so I got drunk the first time, I think, maybe the summer before high school. Maybe it was when I was still in middle school. I remember very well. It was my mom had this like old six pack of Moosehead, and it was warm, and it was disgusting. And I remember I got very sick, which is kind of a thing for me, right? So a lot of people, like, you know, they develop a tolerance for alcohol. You know, they can at least, like, you know, they might not be able to control their drinking, but they can control the, you know, the rapidity of the next drink, right? So they say, okay, well, you know, if I drink six drinks in 10 minutes, yeah, I'm going to get sick. I didn't have that, right? So I was like, you know, six drinks, 10 minutes, let's go. And that's probably why I didn't drink that much, because I was always like, now. So Warm Moosehead, bad experience. You know, but I was cool, right? So I was hanging out with my friends, and, you know, it was cool. You know, it was cool to get drunk, even though I, like, didn't really enjoy it. Which is kind of, you know, the story of that time of my life. And then right before high school, I got high for the first time. And, you know, my world just, like, opened up. You know, people talk about, you know, how there's this gradual descent into alcoholism and that, you know, and I didn't have that. Some people talk about, you know, like, you know, they had their, you know, their first drink, and then, you know, it was, you know, maybe a week or two. It was like, that happened to me the first time, and I was like, from the moment I started, that's all I wanted to do. Probably like a lot of people here in this room, like, I went to high school, but the only reason why I went to high school was to get loaded. And so I went to high school and never went to class. We used to hang out on the sidewalk, smoke cigarettes, and get wasted. And so, you know, that's was just what I wanted to do. And my mom was not pleased, to say the least. She was not too hip to what I was doing at this point. Yeah, I was just about it, and I was about ripping and running, and, you know, I stole from her, and I don't know how many times I took all of the change out of her car, because back then, if you drove on the interstate, at least in New Jersey, there were lots of tolls, and so you needed change. This was before Easy Pass and all that stuff. I remember, like, in the morning, getting ready to go to school, you know, opening up a little change pocket in the car and just grabbing all the quarters or grabbing all the nickels. I did that so many times. You know, at this point, like, we would jokingly, you know, say, me and my friends would jokingly say to each other, you know, we're alcoholics or we're addicts or whatever. But the friends that I hung out with then were like me. It was very strange. Like, so a lot of the people I surrounded myself with were about getting loaded as much as I was, which is always a recipe for disaster. I had my first run-in with the law. I got drunk, and where I grew up, you know, everybody hung up in town, and I lived on the other side of town, and we got wasted. We were drinking 40s, and I got sick, of course, because that's just, you know, what I do when I drink. I drink so much, I get sick. And I remember I was like, so I had my bike, and riding your bike drunk, at least for me, was not an option. I've tried it before. It just doesn't work. It just does not work. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to leave my bike in town, locked up, and I'm going to walk home. So I got to the public library, and I was so wasted, I just couldn't move. So I just, like, sat down behind the library and just went to the bathroom and was just like, all right. Went to the bathroom myself. I got to go home. And so I passed out for a bit, got up, began to walk home, and I remember walking, and then I remember it being black, and then I remember being woken up, and somebody saying to me, hey, come get in the car. Turns out it was a police officer. And so I got in the car. He didn't cuff me. I just got in. Took me to the police station, called my mom. I didn't get arrested, my mom was pissed. To say the least, my mom was pissed. And I think this was probably the first time she realized, like, okay, there's something going on here. I failed out of school. I failed my first year of high school. And my mom sent me to summer school. It was a, you know how there's, like, traveling, like, you know, travel camp, right? So there's summer camp, you travel places. So this was kind of like that, but it was summer school. I really couldn't get anything, but I had kind of manipulated a psychiatrist to give me drugs. So I had that, and, you know, I just put my head down and had nothing else to do but school. So I actually did very well. I came home one weekend and proceeded to get arrested. This is my second run-in with the police. And this time they got me for possession, and I had a weapon, and it wasn't good. My mom was, as I've said before, she was pissed. She was very pissed, especially because, like, so this school that I was at, summer school, that she wanted me to go to in the fall, because it was a boarding school as well, and they were like, nah, he's not coming back. They were like, nah. So at this point, my mom had no clue what to do. And so she decided to send me to a wilderness program in New Mexico. And when they said, you know, I went, I did 3 months, and they were like, yeah, he's not ready to go back into society. So in the 90s, there were these, well, in the 80s and 90s, there were these programs called, I think they were called emotional growth schools. And they've made some documentaries about these kinds of places, like on Netflix. And I go there, and it's fucked up. When they say emotional growth, what they really mean is sobriety through child abuse. I saw a whole bunch of my classmates get abused, mentally, emotionally, physically, sexually. And it was wild. And it was wild. And so one of the things, like, I'm very good at, like, you know, putting my head down and hiding, blending into the wall. And so I was like, all right, I'm just going to, you know, head down and focus on school. And this was when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. The school was, quote unquote, abided by the four absolutes and the 12 steps of recovery. I am glad that AA is nothing like I learned there. So I was there for like 3 years. Did very, very well in school. Very, very well. Got into a pretty good school here in Atlanta. And I graduated, was it 98? And I had been sober, and I had done a 4-step, and I had done all that stuff, and I thought I was going to make it. I didn't do anything that I was told to do when I left, but I thought I was going to make it. So there were about nine months in between when I graduated high school, when I got out of this place, and when I was going to move here to Atlanta. And let's say after about 2 months I drank, and the story I'm probably about to tell is probably not as funny as I think it is, but so the night that I drank, we had Chinese food, and the night that I relapsed after 3.5 years, we had Chinese food. In the fortune cookie, it said, beware of evil temptation. Clearly I ignored that, right? It's like, whatever. Over the next few days, I got into like 3 or 4 car accidents. For none of them I was drunk. You know, fortune cookie was a harbinger of things to come. In fact, I blame everything on this fortune cookie. I blame everything on the fortune cookie. You know, at this point, you know, I drank again, and I drank a second time, got sick, as I do, and I was like, well, maybe I'm going to try the sober thing again. And at this point in time, like, you know, I had not contacted any of my old friends, and I just really didn't have people to hang out with, and I was super lonely. And so I reached out to my old friends, and their lives had not changed. They were, you know, people say people, places, and things, and that is true. So not the first time I hung out with them, but the second time I hung out with them, it was on. And you know, in the big book, it talks about, you know, how you know, the dude that goes and mixes the milk with his whiskey. He's like, you know, I got self-knowledge. It's the dude that didn't drink for 30 years. I got self-knowledge. You know, I can go ahead and drink. But, you know, I was a self-knowledge guy, right? I was like, you know, I'm pretty smart. I know what to look out for. Yeah, what they said, you know, what they said in school is coming true, but, you know, I got this. You know, I know what's up. I know how to interact with people. And within a couple months, like, I was doing things that I never thought I was going to do, doing substances I never thought I was going to do. And so I didn't work that entire summer, and I just, you know, again, my job was getting wasted. And I remember, like, it being, like, a, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. My heart was beating so fast. I remember I was like, I should probably go have my mom take me to the hospital, but, you know, then she'll find out. So I can't do that. I can't do that. Luckily, I didn't die. You know, that's what my drinking was like. It was like, you know, let's go right up to the edge, you know, but if I have to get help, that's going to sacrifice my drinking. So we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. So that summer ends, and I'm going to move to Atlanta to go to school. And I had one of those moments of clarity where it was like, probably a couple days before I left for Atlanta, me and my friends are getting wasted, and I'm watching my, so I got wasted with, so my group of friends were, there were like a whole bunch of people that were my age, and then there was a whole bunch of like people in their 40s, right? And so all of the people's, you know, now looking back at it, all the people that were 40, that was like our future selves, right? And one of those people was my friend's mom, and I watched them like smoke crack together, and I was just like, this is not good. This is not a good situation. What is going on here? Luckily, you know, I left, and so it's, and those, there are more situations like that that come up. And so I come to Atlanta, and it's on. I fall in with the wrong people almost immediately, like we do. And the thing about colleges is, like, there are a lot of people with a lot of money, and there are a lot of people that like to party. And I took full advantage of that. I believe that I could talk people out of the money pretty easily. And so, I, again, didn't go to class. That was a theme in my life, right? So I get to school, and if I had a choice, I was not going to class. I was getting loaded. I failed, of course, because that's what happens when you don't go to class. My mom was like, you're fucking out of your mind. I came home for Christmas, and she was like, you're fucking out of your mind if you think I'm going to pay for you to go back to school if you're not going to do anything. And I was pretty worried, right? So, like, I knew that if I stayed in New Jersey with those friends, I was going to die. Like, that was, like, plain, very plain to me. And so I was like, I don't care if you're not going to send me back to school. I'm going to go back to Atlanta. A couple months later, I come back to Atlanta, take my inheritance, and it's gone in like 2 months. And I have no money. And I'm afraid to get a job. I'm super afraid to get a job. So my roommates are out of town, and, you know, they like to grow things. And I was like, I just rip them off. I did, and I got caught, and they were like, yeah, you can't live here anymore. They're like, yeah, we're going to shoot you if you come back. And so I had no place to go at this point. I end up at a, so I was into raves, and when they were a big thing, and in fact, there, you know, there's somebody in here that I probably rubbed shoulders with that eventually got sober. At raves. And so I was at this show, and I had no place to go, and I called my uncle, and I remember I had a fever, and I was like walking down the side of Memorial Drive in July, It was like, it had to have been like 95 degrees. And I'd been up all night, and I was probably smelling pretty bad. And so I called my uncle. He came to pick me up, and I don't think he knew what to do. So he called my mom, who called. I had a friend of the family, a super close friend of the family that was in recovery. And so he came to pick me up. And he was like, look, dude, like, you know, something's got to change. So he's like, listen, like, and we were on I-20. And he was like, look, dude, you can either get out of the car or I can take you to rehab. And I didn't want to get sober, but I did not want to walk on I-20 in 95 degree weather with a fever. So I was like, all right, you know, you can take me to rehab. And so I ended up at Ridgeview. And my whole thing at this point was just like, all right, you know, I might want to get high, but I'll just be honest with these people. And I would like to tell you that I got sober, but I did not. I eventually left against medical advice, got wasted again, ended up on the south side of town in this fucked up ass rehab. I always end up at these super fucked up places, in this real messed up place. And so I remember saying to one of the counselors there, I just want one more. I just need one more. And I never want to feel like that again. I remember, you know, saying like, you know, it talks about, you know, we can't bring with sufficient force the memory of a week or a month ago. Like, that was me. Or if I did have the memory, like, it's like, I don't give a fuck. I'm willing to, like, sacrifice it all. Again, I go get wasted. And I come back. I get caught. And they're like, and so I start the program again from the beginning. And I would like to say it took this time, but it did not. But I probably stayed sober about 2 years at this point. And so this would have been 2002. And I get wasted again. But at this point, I get wasted, like, while in the three-quarter house, but, like, the dude that was running it was selling meth, and so he was not really probably paying attention to what was going on with me. And so, lo and behold, I run into some people that I was originally with, and they're like, you know, I'm still going to meetings while I'm at this place, right, while I'm getting loaded. So I get in touch with some people that, you know, some people my age that are in recovery that are going to meetings on the north side. And I start hanging with them. And one day starts, you know, one day becomes two becomes three, and so on. And a bunch of my friends, they're, you know, going to do a book study, and they're going to work the steps. And so I want to hang out with my friends, so I work the steps. And I say a lot of the times that I kind of just got sober kind of by mistake. Like, I was just doing what those around me were doing. My life got good. My life got really good. So I knew my life was getting good when it was the day after I had done my fifth step, or 5, 6, and 7, and I was at a movie theater. I had to walk past the movie theater to get back to my three-quarter house from my job. And so I went and saw a ton of movies. And so I remember I went and watched Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. And, you know, Uncle Ben is dying, and he says, what do you say? With great power comes great responsibility, and I start crying, right? So, like, it's like probably like the first, like, real emotional, like, thing that's happened to me in a long time. And, you know, from there, my life gets pretty good. We caused a lot of trouble. Got sober with some of the people in this room, and we caused a lot of trouble. But we didn't drink. And one of the things that people did around me was they did service. And I got involved in young people's AA. And I went back to school. I would like to say I did well in school, but I didn't go to class. I didn't go to class, but I didn't drink. I wasn't all about getting high and drinking. But you think you get sober, and it's like, you know, you go back to school and you're going to do well. That was not my experience. I was, if school didn't come naturally to me, if, you know, what I was working on, like, wasn't easy, I just didn't want to do it. or I was afraid to do it. And, you know, I ran the gamut of majors. It took me 8 years to get a four-year degree. Most of the time I was a full-time student. The fact that Kennesaw did not put me on academic probation, I don't know how that didn't happen, but they never put me on academic probation. Probably because I withdrew from classes before before they actually gave me an F. And so, yeah, so that was kind of like earlier, you know, my first 8 years of recovery. You know, I kind of fucked off and had a lot, you know, had good times, and most of my friends were in school. When I had around 4 years, I think almost all of my closest friends that I got sober with drank. It was fucking devastating. And some of them died, some of them completely destroyed their lives, and some of them got sober again. And that just, you know, you stick around long enough, that's going to happen. I was not prepared for that. I also believed that even though that they drank, that I'd still hang out with them a lot. Yeah, that was not a good move. However, I did stay in touch with them. You know, friendship is like super important to me, and so like I was like, you know, I'm not going to press them. I'm just going to call them every now and again. You know, every couple months, give them a call. What's up? How you doing? Blah 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 blah. There was no. They didn't hide from me, and so you know that was one of the things that like you know even though they were drinking that I like super appreciated is like hey you know. No matter what happens, we're homies. So I eventually graduated. You know, I think in 2008, when my mom retired, she was like, "Look, dude, like, I've supported you long enough. Your ass needs to get out of school." And so in 2010, I finally graduated, and this was shortly after the financial turndown in 2008, and nobody was hiring. So I was like, well, I'm just going to do what I've always done and take a loan and go back to school. And so I decided to go to grad school, and there was a whole, you know, a lot of the times in my recovery, I have acted out of fear, and to this day, I still act out of a lot of fear sometimes. And the whole grad school thing was, so my undergraduate was in mathematics. I wanted to go to grad school for mathematics, but I was scared shitless. I was like, I do not know if I can cut it as a math grad student. And so I didn't go to grad school for math. I ended up staying local and going to grad school for statistics. I know, math statistics was the difference, right? So at any rate, if you want to know the difference, you can come talk to me after the meeting. So I ended up getting a job, and you know, I had a good job. I graduated grad school. At this point, you know, my mom. I think when I was in grad school, my mom had breast cancer, and when I talked to her about it, she was like, yeah, dude, whatever, man, I got it. We'll be good. I was like, all right, man. My mom is, like, super spiritual now and is a super happy person. So happy it makes me, like, so upset sometimes. I'm like, why are you so happy all of the time? God, but she's great. And so I go see her and we deal with that. But, you know, she has cancer, but I can show up for her, right? So I think I drove her to the hospital. I think I drove her to the hospital. Sorry. My memory's not that good. But I can show up, right? So I showed up, took her to the hospital, and, you know, she got through it. At this point in my life, like, I had the job. I didn't have the car, but I had a car. But I had the job. I was making really good money. And, you know, I thought I was it. I thought I had a super important job. And I became very, what's the word? attached to this job. And I thought it was everything. I was like, this job is me. And I got super, you know, as far as my job was concerned, I had no boundaries. It was like, you know, you need to work 3 weeks in a row. I would work 3 weeks in a row, with no day off. You know, I thought it was it. You know, I had the job that I always wanted, but I wasn't fucking happy. Around this time, so when I had 4 years sober, I got a dog. This is relevant in a minute. I love this fucking dog. So this is Sherlock. I fucking love that goddamn dog. So around like the time I had 13 years, I started having a lot of issues with sleep. Started having a lot of issues with anxiety. Sherlock passed away, and that was devastating. I started like laying out of work because I was like so anxious. I'd be in front of clients and I would just start crying. And it was fucked up, y'all. And I just didn't know what was wrong with me. And so one day, you know, I call out of work, and because I was going to, so I remember I was going into work and I was like, I could just ride the elevator up to the top and just jump off the building and nobody, you know, that would be it. It'd be over. And, luckily, I saw my boss, and he was like, dude, you look like shit. So I went to the doctor, I called my sponsor, and so, for those that are new, like, good sponsorship is the fucking key. And not only that, having a sponsor that is humble. So I called my sponsor, and I'm like, look, dude, I'm, like, super fucked up. I was thinking about jumping off this building, and he says to me, he's like, look, dude, like, I can't help you with that. That is an issue that I am not qualified to help you with. You need to seek some outside help. And I was like, well, you got anybody I can call? He was like, yeah. And so I called this person. And my sponsor, just being humble enough to say, like, yeah, I can't help you here. However, there is help. And there is, you know, AA is part of your life, but it is not necessarily the solution for this. And so at 13 years sober, I found myself back at RidU, which was humbling experience, very humbling experience. I remember I got there and my case manager from when I was there as an adolescent came and said hi, and I was like, hi. I was like, I didn't get high, but, you know, I'm back. This was kind of like where I was like, where I learned kind of like, okay, I need to have boundaries with my job. So I left RidU again. And things were pretty good, you know. My, around 2018, I changed my home group. And, because I wasn't going to a lot of meetings, and I just needed a new set of people. And I changed my home groups to what it is now. My home group is Skyland. It meets Tuesdays and Fridays at Oglethorpe Presbyterian Church. Come by sometime. And I started to really have like a real crisis of higher power, right? So I had never really had issues with the whole higher power concept up until like I had, how many years? It would have been 16 years sober. And, you know, I really started just like, fuck this higher power shit. Like, I started, you know, I really started like processing a lot of stuff from my past, and I was like, dude, this shit ton of bad shit happened to me. What's this God shit about? Like, and so, like, I was, you know, I was in that mode, for many, many years, many, many years. And then, much like y'all, like, if the pandemic came and, you know, I got trapped inside my house, and that was awful. I didn't come close to drinking, but I definitely came close to pulling all my hair out, even though I don't have much. I definitely came close to pulling my hair out. I didn't really see anybody, I think, for, like, the first year, like, any friends. I saw you, I think, when was it? In Christmas of that year. But that was it. I hadn't seen anybody. And Yeah, and so that was the pandemic. Me playing video games when I was supposed to be working. And that's what I did. And I didn't go to meetings, and yeah, there were online meetings. I was like, fuck that, I'm not going to go. Because, you know, not that Alcoholics Anonymous is a social experience, but for me, coming to meetings, you know, I have a lot of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's important to me. So during this whole time, so I've been in four different groups. I've been GSR four different times. Even though I wasn't going to meetings, I made my district meeting. I was GSR. I made my district meeting almost, I'd probably say 90% of the time, even though I wasn't going to meetings. I went to my district meeting, and that was super important to me. Like, so honoring my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous is super important to me. Probably because I have this chip where I'm like, oh, if I don't do it, nobody else is going to do it. Somebody will step up if I don't do it. But it was super important to me to do it. A couple years ago, I got elected DCM. And, you know, my sponsor had been DCM, and he hadn't told me that how much work it was. So if you guys ever run into your DCM, thank them. Because it is the most thankless job in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't vote. We are just, you know, the conduits of information. Or they are just the conduits of information. And there's a lot of work involved. So if you run into your DCM, who is Thomas, Thomas R., thank them, because it's a lot of work. And they probably are like the linchpins to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we're almost up to the present here, and I'm right on time. So one thing I've learned in my recovery is, like, I make a shit ton of mistakes, and life is going to happen, and I'm going to do dumb shit, and I'm not going to listen to people. So there was a situation that happened in my life last year, where people were like, I was talking to people about it, like, yeah, it's not a good idea. Yeah, it's not a good idea. My therapist was like, yeah, it's not a good idea. I was like, I don't give a fuck what y'all say. I'm going to fucking do it. And shit blew up in my face again. And, you know, that shit happens. And I really had to, you know, just kind of pick myself up and say, okay, like, let's just fucking throw myself back into Alcoholics Anonymous. So during this period of time, I don't think I went to a meeting for a couple months. When I get upset and I tend to get on my couch, play video games, watch the news, and watch a ton of reality TV. And it is fucking terrible. Like 90 Day Fiance, and shit that I would not normally fucking watch. I hate that stuff. I absolutely hate that stuff. I think one time when I was super upset, I started watching Grey's Anatomy. And that show is terrible. It's fucking bad. It's real bad. But yeah, that's what I do when I get upset. And I just end up in the house. But eventually I got my shit together. I was like, all right, go back to meetings. And, they welcomed me back with open arms in my own group. As I said, like, life happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You get sober, and that's what happens. You get sober. That doesn't mean everything else stops. If you're enrolled in school and you don't go to class, you fail. You can still make dumb decisions. Getting sober does not, you know, make you immune from that. However, getting sober and staying sober does enable you to fix those situations, right? You know, it gives you the chance to right the wrong, so to say. I say a lot, you know, one of the things I think about a lot is, okay, you know, what does Alcoholics Anonymous do for me in regards to drinking, right? And so I say, a lot of times I say to myself, the one thing that Alcoholics Anonymous gives me is, gives me that, you know, few seconds between thought and action, like, oh, I think I might want to drink, you know, or I might see, you know, some beer on a TV commercial or something, like, oh, that looks good, you know. From the point I say it's that looks good to, like, that's probably not a good idea. That space in between, God, or whatever you want to call it, like, that is the gift Alcoholics Anonymous gives me. It gives me that, you know, that pause. Much to the point where, like, if I'm going to, you know, my boss tells me to do something, even though he pays me to do it, I get mad. I don't react. Right? I say, this is probably a bad idea if I react to this. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me. It gives me those few seconds, those few minutes to, you know, to say to myself, let me call my sponsor. Or, you know, let me call a friend. You know, phone it in. Phone a friend. That's really, you know, that's really what I feel Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, is those few moments of sanity between the thought and the action. Mm-hmm. I think that's all I got. So thank you.
First I slip and then I quit to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me and finally wake in there I see. I look into love's window for a soul. Take me where the promise is.